This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs. Sam Knight will be back next week, unless he chooses not to come back to the United States. Choice that, given everything we've witnessed lately, I would not blame him for. So I'm doing the show solo today and for the rest of the week. Here's what we got lined up on today's episode. One of the most predatory industries out there, the credit reporting agencies, just got slapped with a major fine from the federal government. We'll go over some changes that could be coming to the industry as a result of their years of abuse. Also, it was only a matter of time, but an oversized depiction of a Donald Trump tweet has made it to the Senate floor. I'll explain who's responsible for it and why it was absolutely necessary. And later, if Donald Trump is actually planning to purge civil servants when he comes into office, then House Republicans just made his job a lot easier. I'll break down some new rules that were quietly passed that could spell doom for some government workers. But first, before we get to all of that, a big hearing today on Capitol Hill. The Senate Armed Services Committee hosted, that's chaired by Senator John McCain, senator who is almost never mad. The guy's never been mad before. It's bizarre. John McCain chairs the Senate Armed Services Committee, which hosted spy chiefs from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, Defense Intelligence Agency, and the NSA. At the topic of that hearing, Russian interference in last November's election. And while it was believed that we might finally get some hard evidence, that we might finally get some answers to some of the most pressing questions on this issue, we're still going to have to wait a few more days. We were informed at the hearing that a final report from the intelligence community on the matter will be finished next week, at which point there will be another series of hearings on Capitol Hill, and hopefully a version of that report will be released to the public. Until then, though, the spy chiefs during Thursday's hearing didn't really offer any new evidence to lend credibility to the claims that have already been made by anonymous officials in intel agencies, as well as through joint statements from these intelligence agencies about Russian election interference. And to be completely honest, if there's one person, just one person to be trusted making claims to Congress before evidence is dropped, it's not James Clapper, who is on hand testifying today. James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, he's notorious for already lying to Congress. You might remember back in 2013, he was asked by Senator Ron Wyden if the NSA collects any sort of information on Americans, to which Clapper said no. To which Edward Snowden, a few months later, released evidence showing that, yes, indeed, the NSA does collect information on virtually all Americans, their telephone records, through the phone metadata program. So we're going to have to wait until next week on for some of these questions to be answered on Russian election interference. And those of us who are thus far unsatisfied with the evidence provided on this, we're going to have to wait until next week, which is fine. I just hope we actually see some evidence. So far, the statements provided by the government on this matter have yet to include that evidence. And to be honest, it's a little strange how far this debate has progressed, how much ink has been spilled at major newspapers, how many allegations have been thrown around, accusations, all of it before we've seen a final analysis from the spy community about what actually happened. We'll get some answers next week. It's also worth noting that even when the final report comes out, a lot of the supposed hard evidence, well, that might be redacted from public view. So we still might not get definitive answers. I mean, here was James Clapper today talking about the dilemma that the intel community finds itself in regarding making such evidence public.
We have invested billions, and we put people's lives at risk to glean such information. And so if we were to fulsomely expose it in such a way that would be completely persuasive to everyone, then we can just kiss that off, because we'll lose it. And then that will endanger our, imperil our ability to provide such intelligence in the future. And that's all the dilemma that we have in intelligence. We want to be as forthcoming and transparent as possible, but we feel very, very strongly, as we do in this case, about protecting very fragile and sensitive sources and methods.
So that's the reason offered by James Clapper as to why more convincing evidence has not been released yet to the public. By the way, this is a pretty routine response from U.S. spies when they're trying to reveal things to the public. We saw it play out over and over again during the Snowden affair, when the intel community would make claims about Snowden or the harm of his disclosures, but then didn't offer any evidence to back those claims up, alleging that by releasing such evidence, it could harm sources and methods. So that's something to keep in mind when we finally do get this full report sometime next week. Now, there was, though, one interesting exchange that happened during the hearing, and it relates to something that's largely been absent from this debate about Russian interference in the U.S. election. And that is, to what extent the Russians were doing something that the U.S. has already normalized on a global scale. And this is important because when it comes to the hack of the Office of Personnel Management a few years ago, the OPM, alleged to have been perpetrated by the Chinese, our spy chiefs had a specific warning to Congress about being careful with retaliation. Essentially, James Clapper, and he's now said this on repeated occasions, and he again repeated it during Thursday's hearing, he echoed this old saw about how those who are living in glass houses shouldn't throw rocks, and that the hack of the OPM a few years ago and the subsequent theft of records with personal information of more than 20 million Americans, information like their social security numbers, addresses, stuff like that, that theft at the OPM was just standard espionage, standard spycraft, the likes of which the U.S. is actively involved in as well. So here was Clapper making that same argument on Thursday.
I would say that this was espionage. It was not an attack per se. And of course, I always a bit reticent about, people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw publicly too many rocks. So there is, a difference between, an act of espionage, which we conduct as well, and other nations do.
So a difference between an act of espionage, the OPM act, and then Clapper went on to say what happened with alleged election interference, that there's a difference there. And this is a point that Senator Lindsey Graham later picked up on and noted that in the latter case of election interference, then throwing rocks would be completely appropriate.
Is there a difference between espionage and interfering in an election?
Yes, espionage implies a passive.
Yeah. Okay.
Passive collection, and this was much more activist.
So, when it comes to espionage, we better be careful about throwing rocks. When it comes to interfering in our election, we better be ready to throw rocks. Do you agree with that?
That's a good metaphor.
So to recap our metaphors here, it's not okay to retaliate against Chinese espionage because the U.S. does it too. But it is okay to retaliate against Russian election interference because that's not something that the U.S. does. This is the metaphor being put forward by United States senators and our spy chiefs during this hearing. And now the obvious problem with that sort of thinking, though, is that the U.S. too has interfered in its share of elections all around the world. And thus, wouldn't Director Clapper's analogy apply in this case too? That maybe we shouldn't be throwing rocks in our glass house, not just when it comes to espionage, but also when it comes to election interference? That was the gist of the argument that Republican Senator Tom Tillis made during the hearing.
Director Clapper, I'm going to spend most of my time probably reflecting on some of the comments that you've made. The glass house comment is something I think is very important. There's been research done by a professor up at Carnegie Mellon that Mellon, that's estimated that the United States has been involved in one way or another in 81 different elections since World War II. That doesn't include coups or regime changes. So tangible evidence where we've tried to affect an outcome to our purpose. Russia's done it some 36 times. In fact, when Russia apparently was trying to influence our election, we had the Israelis accusing us of trying to influence their election. So I'm not here to talk about that, but I am here to say that we live in a big glass house and there are a lot of rocks to throw, and I think that's consistent with what you said on other matters.
So Tillis raising a pretty interesting point here that seems to undercut the argument that was made by James Clapper and other senators on the panel. Now, worth mentioning that none of the spy chiefs or senators responded to Senator Tillis's analysis here, but it's important. Again, this isn't just about trying to determine if indeed the Russians actually did hack the DNC and actually did hack John Podesta's email service and then pass what they found off to WikiLeaks, thus interfering in the U.S. election. Now, something that honestly, you know, would surprise no one, including myself, but something we should still demand evidence of before drawing that conclusion. You know, there's a lot of smearing of people, a lot of smearing going on of people who are asking for more evidence. Not many people are out there, you know, going saying the Russians did not do this. They're just out there asking for evidence, which is the responsible thing to be doing, especially when we're talking about U.S. intelligence agencies that just in the last 15 years, not to mention going back longer before that, but just in the last 15 years, have proven themselves to be capable of lying all the time. Whether it's lying about weapons of mass destruction, lying about torture, lying about spying on the Senate, lying about domestic surveillance, it's worth asking evidence when they make claims. It's also about understanding the context in which this alleged election interference took place, something that's largely been missing in these discussions since people, Americans, are reluctant to bring up the U.S.'s sordid past in tampering with foreign elections. But it did briefly get a mention during Thursday's hearing. The rest of the stuff, though, we'll wait until next week. And I'll just say, hopefully this new report set to come out next week has more substance than prior intel reports on the matter. And I say that because we now know there have been a lot of problems with what's already been released by the government to prove that the Russians interfered in the election. You might remember last week, the intel agencies released their latest report on this. It was titled Grizzly Step, and it purported to offer more evidence that the Russians did indeed hack into the DNC and John Podesta's email and pass that information on to WikiLeaks. It didn't do that, though. And in fact, all it did was muddy things even further. As Michael Lee over at The Intercept reported this week, the so-called evidence presented could actually implicate innocent web users and lead to false positives of Russian hacking, as we saw last week with the whole Vermont utility fiasco. You know, the Washington Post reported that the Russians had hacked into a U.S. energy grid through a Burlington Electric, a Vermont utility company, only to have to, a few days later, the Washington Post walk back that report, saying, actually, that wasn't true at all. That's not at all what happened. One of many stories that the Washington Post has had to walk back related to alleged Russian election interference. But Michael Lee, focusing on this Grizzly Step report last week, he notes essentially the government put out a list of 876 suspicious IP addresses that were suspected of being used by Russian hackers. Now, an IP address, it's a unique identifier for a computer or computers. Think of it as the computer's telephone number. And when a computer goes to a website, it leaves its IP address on the weblog as kind of a signature. Anyway, the U.S. government identified 876 such IP addresses as ones used by Russian hackers. And Mika did some research on each of those IP addresses, and he found that 367 of those 876 suspicious IP addresses, 367 of them, or 42% of them, were simply Tor exit nodes. Tor is an internet service that uses computer ports all around the world to route computer traffic, people who are browsing on the internet, if they want to hide their location or browse anonymously, they can use Tor, and it routes their searches and their web browsing through various nodes all around the world, therefore masking where their original location is. And while, yes, Russian hackers may use some of these same tools, they may use Tor and go through some of these same exit nodes, so too might any individual web surfer who's using Tor. So when Micah reviewed his own blog for traces of these IP addresses, he writes, quote, "So I searched my web server logs for the suspicious IP addresses, and I was shocked to discover over 80,000 web requests from IPs used by Russian hackers in the last 14 months. Of course, this wasn't a massive cyber operation against Micah's personal blog. It was just people visiting his blog using the very popular Tor server. Micah adds in his report, quote, "It's plausible, and in my opinion likely, that hackers under orders from the Russian government were responsible for the DNC and Podesta hacks in order to influence the U.S. election in favor of Donald Trump. But the Grizzly Step report fails to adequately back up this claim. My research, for example, shows that much of the evidence presented is evidence of nothing at all." So that was an analysis of the report that the U.S. government released last week, purported to show more evidence that the Russians did indeed interfere in the U.S. election. And as we see now, nearly half of all the IP addresses listed as Russian hacking signatures were just Tor exit nodes that can be used by anybody and are used by anybody regularly. And then there was this report from BuzzFeed, which revealed that the FBI and intelligence agencies didn't actually review the DNC servers that were hacked. This was a bombshell report reported by BuzzFeed on Wednesday. We'll get to more of it here. I got to take a quick break. More dissent coming up. Welcome back to Unanimous Dissent. One Sam still here with you, holding down the fort. If you haven't yet, check out the website, districtsentinel.com, for some of the latest news coming out of Washington, D.C., a website that I and the other Sam Knight, run. It's got good stuff on it. So before the break, I was talking about the hearing today on alleged Russian election interference. We're going to get a report next week that's going to be a final report that's going to lay it all out, the evidence of how the intel community has come to these conclusions that the Russians did indeed hack the DNC, hack John Podesta's email, and then turn that information over to WikiLeaks to interfere in the election. Now, complicating things here, and something that oddly was not addressed at all in today's hearing, pretty important story that BuzzFeed reported on Wednesday. And that's this. Essentially, the FBI and intelligence agencies didn't even examine the DNC servers that were hacked. I'm going to just read from the BuzzFeed report here. Quote, 6 months after the FBI first said it was investigating the hack of the Democratic National Committee's computer network, the Bureau has still not requested access to the hacked servers, a DNC spokesman said. No U.S. government entity has run an independent forensic analysis on the system, one U.S. intelligence official told BuzzFeed News. Now, in an email to BuzzFeed, Eric Walker, the DNC's deputy communications director, stated, quote, the DNC had several meetings with representatives of the FBI Cyber Division and its Washington, D.C. field office, the Department of Justice's National Security Division, and U.S. Attorney's offices, and it responded to a variety of requests for cooperation, but the FBI never requested access to the DNC's computer servers. So that means that all the conclusions, all the analyses, everything that's come out of the FBI and the intel community about the alleged hack so far, all of it is from a secondhand source. All of it relies on reporting done not by an intel agency, not by the U.S. government, but by a private cyber defense firm, CrowdStrike, which conducted the initial review of the breach servers at the DNC and shared that information with the federal government. The FBI did not comment on the BuzzFeed story, but an intelligence official stated, quote, CrowdStrike is pretty good. There's no reason to believe that anything that they have concluded is not accurate, except for the fact that, like any private company, they have a profit motive. And let's face it, there's a profit incentive to push out a story that a big bad government is hacking everybody so that everybody needs to use our service. I don't know what CrowdStrike's motive here is, but I'm just saying we've been lectured that we all need to trust our intelligence agencies, and then we learn that our intelligence agencies didn't even examine the hacked servers. So in reality, we need to have blind faith in private cyber defense firms. BuzzFeed added that it spoke to three cybersecurity companies who have worked on major breaches in the last 15 months, who said that it was par for the course for the FBI to do their own forensic research into the hacks. End quote. But for some reason, in this case, they didn't do that. And even stranger, this wasn't brought up once during the hearing. Not a single senator thought it was important to ask any of the intel agency heads if their department actually reviewed the hacked DNC servers. I mean, even Republicans on the panel who have been skeptical, like the president-elect, like Trump has been, of the claims that anonymous officials have made at these agencies, none of them thought to ask whether or not U.S. government entities actually reviewed the hacked DNC servers. So the allegations of Russian election interference, they've created a bit of a brouhaha between the president-elect Donald Trump and the CIA. And that feud, that conflict, is likely to escalate upon reports that Trump is drawing up plans to downsize the spy agency and reform the intelligence community. The Trump team has denied this, but the Wall Street Journal reported this week that that Trump is eyeing both the Central Intelligence Agency and the Office of Director of National Intelligence for changes, with an official close to the transition team saying that, quote, the view from the Trump team is the intelligence world is becoming completely politicized. They all need to be slimmed down. The focus will be on restructuring agencies and how they interact. It was reported that Trump is devising these plans with the help of his controversial national security advisor pick, retired General Michael Flynn, as well as with Kansas Congressman Mike Pompeo, who's been tapped by Trump to head the CIA. Pompeo has a confirmation hearing set for next week. So Trump reportedly wants to shrink the ODNI. He wants to cut staffing at the CIA's Virginia headquarters and assign more people to field posts. Trump team, again, once again, is denying that they're doing this. But a lot of this comes out of this disagreement between Trump and the intel community about just how solid the evidence is that Russia interfered in last November's election. Trump has received intel briefings on the matter, but has argued that they weren't convincing. He's set to receive another briefing on Friday. Apparently, the final report here that we're going to get next week, Trump's going to get a briefing on the matter on Friday, and Trump has promised to speak about it afterward. So that's kind of the backdrop of what's happening here, this feud between Trump and the CIA. Now, interestingly, downsizing and disempowering sprawling intelligence agencies that have been known to run amok and become too political may have actually been something that Democrats could have gotten behind at some point. After all, the CIA under George W. Bush established an illegal torture program, built a drone program with very little accountability. Then under Barack Obama, that same CIA spied on Democrats in the U.S. Senate who were investigating torture, lied about the efficacy of torture. I mean, it's hard to reconcile American values with the actions of the CIA over the last decade and a half. And the same with the Office of Director of National Intelligence. Remember, it was the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, in 2013, who lied to Congress and the American people about domestic surveillance. I've mentioned that already, but worth mentioning again. But partisanship is one hell of a drug. And now with a Democrat in the White House relying on the CIA's conclusions here, Democratic voters largely support the CIA. An NBC Wall Street Journal poll this week showed that 46% of Democrats view the CIA positively, compared to just 14% who view it negatively. That's right, after robotic drone killings, torture, spying, lying, all of that, only 14% of Democrats are like, you know what, the CIA is actually pretty bad. Just 14% of Democrats think that. As you'd expect, Republicans are on the opposite side because of partisanship, with only 29% viewing the CIA favorably and 24% viewing it negatively. Speaking of the bizarre outcomes of hyper-partisanship in our political sphere, we now have people like Sarah Palin and Sean Hannity praising the likes of Julian Assange. When there was, I mean, it wasn't too long ago when Assange was spilling secrets of U.S. war crimes, and people like Palin and Hannity were calling for Assange to be executed. Now they think he's just great. He's just great. Life comes at you fast, folks. And things are only going to get weirder as we head into the future. But thankfully, let's just stop talking about Russia for a moment and the old election shenanigans. Instead, let's focus on the shenanigans that congressional Republicans are up to. Stuff they're actively working on that could directly harm people. So on yesterday's show, I laid out this bizarre scenario related to Obamacare repeal and replace. Based on what Speaker of the House Paul Ryan and Vice President-elect Mike Pence told reporters Wednesday about their plans with the Affordable Care Act, it appears as though significant portions of the law will stay in place even after congressional Republicans move to repeal it. And not only that, it very well could be the Trump White House that issues those executive orders keeping in place portions of Obamacare. Now think about that for a second. Remember all that criticism that the president received about executive orders and separately about the Affordable Care Act? Well, Trump, on his first day in office, could be issuing executive orders to keep Obamacare in place. You really can't make this stuff up, and you really can't make up this next bit of news. After spending years and years railing against the Obama administration for not securing U.S. diplomatic outposts around the world and allowing Benghazi to happen, Republicans have introduced legislation to slash embassy security funding around the world. I'm not joking. Senators Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, and Dean Heller put forward a bill this week that would force the U.S. State Department to move the Israeli embassy from Tel Aviv, where it's currently located, to Jerusalem, a move that would fulfill a demand made by Congress back in 1995, but one that each U.S. president since has issued a waiver against following, citing national security concerns. There's a fear that moving the embassy to Jerusalem, an international city claimed by several religions and people, would destroy any hope of a two-state solution. It would inflame Palestinians and pose a huge setback to peace in the region. Yet it's something that Trump says he plans to do. And the trio of senators plan to force him to do it by introducing legislation that would ensure the president can't issue another waiver. And it would impose consequences if he does. The bill would immediately cut in half funding for embassy security, construction, and maintenance until the embassy is relocated to Jerusalem. Again, funding for embassy security would be slashed in half under their legislation. And then in fiscal years 2018 and 2019, that funding, that security and construction and maintenance funding, would be completely cut off until the embassy in Tel Aviv is relocated. I mean, this is just completely insane, particularly so when you consider the past comments that these lawmakers have made about the need to protect diplomatic outposts around the world in the wake of Benghazi. As Zed Jelani, who's appeared on this show a few times, as Zed Jelani pointed out over at The Intercept, 8 months after the Benghazi attack, Senator Ted Cruz wrote in the National Review, quote, "Our brave men and women who continue to put their lives on the line every day in similar dangerous situations deserve to know we are doing everything possible, not only to protect them in the event of a terrorist attack, but also to deter these attacks from happening again, better late than ever." That's what Ted Cruz wrote. And today he's putting forward legislation to cut security funding in half and maybe altogether. Marco Rubio, too, last summer wrote, quote, "It is my hope that this report serves as a reminder of the importance of allocating the appropriate resources to keep all Americans safe, both at home and around the world. Congress and the executive branch need to work together to do everything possible to make sure something like this does not happen again." Okay, well, if we don't want it to happen again, then why, Senator Rubio, are you putting your name on legislation that slashes diplomatic security funding? Call his office up. Ask him. Here's something else House Republicans did in this first week of the 115th Congress. They lived up to a promise made by people close to Trump that he could be planning to purge government workers and civil servants. Now, we've previously on this show reported how Chris Christie, back when he was heading Trump's transition team, hinted that Trump was eyeing to weaken civil service protection laws that would allow him to fire people easier. As Christie said at the time, Trump likes to fire people. And we also had that memo that went out from the Trump transition team to the Energy Department asking for the names of employees that worked on the Paris Climate Agreement or that studied the harmful effects of carbon pollution. It added fuel to those concerns that Trump is going to be purging government workers. Well, sure enough, on Tuesday, as most of us were distracted by the Republicans' attack on the Office of Congressional Ethics, which they eventually backed off from thanks to a torrent of phone calls from constituents and two tweets from Donald Trump, Republicans snuck in a different provision into a rules package that passed. That provision, known as the Holman Rule, will give lawmakers the power to target specific programs and even specific employees within the government and then dock their pay or eliminate their position. This was a rule created back in 1876, but it was dropped in 1983 and it hasn't been brought back since. And House Republicans didn't downplay just how powerful bringing back the rule could be. House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy said that voters elected Trump with the hope of fundamentally changing the way government works, and that the Holman Rule gives Congress a chance to do just that. Quote, this is a big rule change inside there that allows people to get at places they hadn't before. Democrats and groups that protect civil service workers have described it as the Armageddon Rule. Here was House Minority Whip Steny Hoyer speaking on the House floor against it.
Reinstating the Holman Rule would make it easier for the majority to circumvent the current legislative process in order to fire or cut the pay of federal employees. It undermines civil service protection. It goes back to the 19th century. Republicans have consistently made our hardworking federal employees scapegoats, in my opinion, for lack of performance of the federal government itself. And this rule changes will enable them to make short-sighted and ideologically driven changes to our nation's civil service.
As the Washington Post went on to report, the rule changes the process of passing spending bills by allowing any rank-and-file House member to propose an amendment that would cut a specific federal program or the jobs of specific federal employees by slashing their salaries or eliminating their positions altogether. Before this rule, lawmakers were unable to specifically target programs or individual employees when they were appropriating funds. The Post went on to describe how this new rule, it's also got to be approved by the Senate, by the way, how it might be wielded. Quote, for example, the House could have voted to significantly reduce the salary of Lois Lerner, the senior executive at the center of the IRS scandal that gave extra scrutiny to conservative groups seeking tax-exempt status. Lawmakers could, in theory, even vote to roll back the 2.1% pay raise Obama gave federal employees starting this year. So this is an example of how Republicans are wielding their power already, just a few days into the new 115th Congress. And you can imagine this being used, this rule being used to target members, civil servants within the federal government who are working on things that are just, you know, things that the Republicans don't like. Trump sent that memo to the Department of Energy. His transition team eventually backed off it, saying they didn't approve of this memo. But the Holman Rule will allow Republican lawmakers to target specific employees at the Department of Energy who might have been working with the Paris Climate Agreement or studying the harmful effects of carbon. It would allow Republicans to dock their pay down to $1, force them out of the job. That's how dangerous this is. This is something that should concern all government employees. And frankly, it should just concern all of us. We'll have more dissent coming up after this. Unanimous dissent still here with you, still broadcasting. Out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C., I'm Sam Sachs, one half of the District Sentinel news team. You can read all of our latest reports over at districtsentinel.com. All right, staying on Capitol Hill, next week is going to be a very busy week full of confirmation hearings for those tapped to be in Trump's cabinet. First, on January 10th, it will be Senator Jeff Sessions' confirmation hearing to be Attorney General. And The Nation is reporting that Republicans on the committee are already locking down the proceedings to make it easier for Mr. Sessions. For example, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Chuck Grassley, is refusing to expand the number of witnesses who will testify on behalf or against Mr. Sessions, including restricting Democrats to calling only four people over 2 days. By the way, the last nominee who left the Senate to be the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, received a four-day hearing. Sessions is scheduled to receive a two-day hearing. Grassley has also rejected calls from Democrats on the panel to delay that hearing due to the lack of sufficient responses provided by Mr. Sessions to questions from the committee. Now, if this was a non-controversial nominee, you could see why there would be reluctance to delay the hearing or to cut it short or restrict the number of witnesses. But Sessions is one of the most controversial nominees in recent memory. I mean, this isn't the first time even that Sessions was considered for a role. His nomination was considered by the Judiciary Committee back in 1986. The committee rejected Sessions' nomination to a federal judgeship because of racist things he said and done in the past. It's one reason why eight members of the local NAACP, including the president of the local group, were arrested this week for a sit-in at Jeff Sessions' Senate office. It's another reason why the executive director of the ACLU laid out an exhaustive report casting all sorts of doubt on Jeff Sessions as attorney general. The report questions if Sessions will actually provide oversight over abusive police forces, if he might oversee the return of police militarization, if he'll actually protect voting rights, if he'll stand up for due process for undocumented immigrants, if he'll work to address mass incarceration, if he'll defend religious liberty and the rights of LGBT citizens, if he'll protect victims of domestic abuse, guard against domestic surveillance, crack down on torture. The ACLU wasn't confident in any of that stuff. Concluding, quote, if members of the Senate Judiciary Committee do their job well on January 10th and 11th, members of Congress and the American people will know if Senator Jeff Sessions is the most qualified person to be the 84th Attorney General of the United States. The members of the Senate Judiciary Committee should only vote for Sessions if they truly believe he is up to task of being the country's highest ranking law enforcement official. So this is not even close to an open and closed case. A lot of people don't think Sessions should get the job. But despite all that, it appears as though Judiciary Chairman Chuck Grassley is trying to make it as easy as possible for his buddy, Mr. Sessions, to be confirmed. Mark it on your calendars, folks. January 10th next week, some must-see programming on C-SPAN. They got some news for you out of Guantanamo Bay. Four detainees were transferred out of the military prison today, placed in the custody of the Saudi Arabian government, out of the frying pan into the fire. Reuters noted that it will be the first in Obama's final flurry of transfers out of the prison. The administration hopes to send as many as 19 prisoners to at least four countries, including Italy, Oman, and the United Arab Emirates, before Donald Trump is sworn in a few weeks. If all those transfers go through, that will leave only about 40 prisoners remaining at Guantanamo Bay, far fewer than the number when President Obama inherited the controversial prison, but still well short of his initial promise to close Gitmo, promise he made on day one of his presidency. The president's failure to close Gitmo all but assures that the facility will remain open indefinitely. President-elect Trump has promised as much. He tweeted this week, quote, there should be no further releases from Gitmo. These are extremely dangerous people and should not be allowed back onto the battlefield. Trump has promised to put more people in Gitmo, including Americans suspected of terrorism. So that's our future at Gitmo here under Trump. Okay, let's move now on to some economic news for the 99%.
Food Street! High Street! Food Street! High Street! Food Street! High Street!
Some of the most notoriously abusive companies out there
The ones that receive the most complaints from consumers for their predatory practices are credit reporting agencies. You've probably seen their ads on TV, or you had to sign up with one of them in order to rent an apartment or get a loan or something, only to find out that suddenly you're being charged $20 a month just so you can have a look-see at your credit score, something that you think should not cost you a single penny. Anyway, some of the most notorious credit reporting agencies just got slapped by the U.S. government. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, announced this week that it has ordered TransUnion and Equifax to pay more than $23 million in fines and restitution for its mass deception of consumers. In a statement, CFPB Director Richard Cordray said, quote, TransUnion and Equifax deceived consumers about the usefulness of the credit scores they marketed and lured consumers into expensive, recurring payments with false promises. Credit scores are central to a consumer's financial life, and people deserve honest and accurate information about them. The CFPB stated that the companies violated the Wall Street Reform Act and the Consumer Financial Protection Act. The agency laid out some specifics, reading from the CFPB report here, quote, in their advertising, TransUnion and Equifax falsely represented that the credit scores they marketed and provided to consumers were the same scores lenders typically use to make credit decisions. In fact, the scores sold by TransUnion and Equifax were not typically used by lenders to make those decisions. The watchdog also accused the companies of deceiving customers into enrolling in subscription programs. Specifically, CFPB states, quote, in their advertising, TransUnion and Equifax falsely claimed that their credit scores and credit-related products were free, or in the case of TransUnion, cost only $1. In reality, consumers who signed up received a free trial of 7 or 30 days, after which they were automatically enrolled into a subscription program, and unless they canceled during the trial period, consumers were charged a recurring fee, usually $16 or more per month. The billing structure, known as negative option, was not clearly and conspicuously disclosed to consumers. Reuters noted that TransUnion, Equifax, and another credit reporting agency, Experian, are among the 10 companies about which the CFPB receives the most consumer complaints. Several large banks and mortgage lenders also make the list. The enforcement actions against TransUnion and Equifax include paying more than $17.6 million in total restitution to harmed consumers. TransUnion must provide more than $13.9 million in restitution. Equifax must also pay $3.8 million in their restitution. The companies must send notification letters about the restitution to affected consumers. The companies will also have to truthfully represent the usefulness of credit scores they sell. TransUnion and Equifax must clearly inform consumers about the nature of the scores they are selling to consumers. Also, moving forward, before enrolling a consumer in any credit-related product, TransUnion and Equifax must obtain the consumer's consent and provide an easy way to cancel products and services. So if you sign up for that free credit report online by just one click of the mouse, then you should be able to cancel that subscription with just one click of the mouse, not having to call someone, wait on hold for an hour, and then be able to cancel the subscription. Also, a bunch of penalties the companies are going to have to pay, $5.5 million in total penalties. So that's good news. That's good stuff. We like it here at Unanimous Dissent when misbehaving companies are punished. Next up, avid watchers of C-SPAN know that lawmakers frequently use the Congressional Graphics Office to make these big posters to assist them in their floor speeches. You might have seen them. Those posters usually have charts and graphs and stuff that help the lawmakers make their point as they're speaking on the floor of the House or the floor of the Senate. But in the age of Trump, there was speculation that eventually a lawmaker would use the graphics office to just create a big poster of one of Donald Trump's tweets. And sure enough, all it took was the second full day of Congress for exactly that to happen. And the lawmaker who did that was the main man, Senator Bernie Sanders. Sanders brought to the Senate floor on Wednesday an enlarged version of a tweet that Donald Trump sent out on May 7th, 2015, that read, quote, I was the first and only potential GOP candidate to state that there will be no cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Huckabee copied me, referring to the other Republican candidate, Mike Huckabee, who didn't really go anywhere. Now, Sanders used this tweet from Donald Trump back on May 7, 2015, to make a point about Republicans in Congress and what they're up to, which is a plan to privatize and voucherize Medicare and Medicaid, something that Donald Trump tweeted he would never do. I'll let Mr. Sanders speak for himself on the matter.
Well, it seems to me that Mr. Trump right now has got to do one of two things. Number one, if all that he was talking about was campaign rhetoric, then what he was obliged to do now is to tell the American people I was lying. Yeah, I said that I would not support cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, but I was lying. But if that is not what the case is, if he was sincere, then I would hope that tomorrow or maybe today he could send out a tweet and tell his Republican colleagues to stop wasting their time and all of our time. And for Mr. Trump to tell the American people that he will veto any proposal that cuts Medicare, that cuts Medicaid, and that cuts Social Security.
So Bernie makes a pretty good point here. I mean, people voted for Trump to do a number of different things, but one thing they didn't vote for Trump to do was to cut entitlement programs. Over and over and over again during the Republican primary and on the during the general on the campaign trail, Trump promised he would not cut Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. He said it wasn't fair to people who've been paying into these systems. He wasn't going to do it. And that distinguished himself during the Republican primary from all the other candidates who did want to cut these entitlement programs, programs that are extremely popular with the American people. So now Trump's been elected and he's got the Republicans in Congress positioning themselves to pass legislation to voucherize, to privatize at least Medicare and to cut Medicaid. So Trump's in a bit of a bind here. And, so far, he has not responded to Bernie Sanders' requests. He's not specified whether he was lying when he tweeted about protecting Medicare, nor has he issued a veto threat against Republicans' plans to cut the program. Curious to see how he handles this over the next few days. All right, we're coming near the end of the show. Got a few more things to talk about here. App makers in Silicon Valley are coming out with a new tool for people to cope with the coming Trump years. Look, we know that the president-elect is a prolific tweeter, tweets all the time, basically sets the news agenda each morning with a tweet. And we know that those tweets could have huge effects, lasting effects on foreign and domestic policy. And they could also have an effect on your stock holdings, assuming you're, you know, one of the half of the country that actually has stock holdings. We've seen over and over again Trump target individual companies that he's not fond of, lashing out at those companies on Twitter. And what that leads to is precipitous declines in those companies' stocks. As The Hill noted, stock prices for Boeing, Lockheed Martin, General Motors, and Ford all took deep dives after the president-elect attacked them on Twitter. And this could be problematic for those of us who might have stock in those companies. Well, now there's an app for that. It's called Trigger. And what it does is it informs users if Trump tweets about a company that they hold stock in. I'm just going to read from a blog post by the app developers explaining how their app works. Quote, "While it's no surprise that Trump has been actively tweeting since the election, no one anticipated that a single tweet could potentially eradicate billions of dollars in market cap from large companies." The company adds, quote, "If his tweets on prices and contracts with public companies have had significant market-moving events that make it more difficult for the everyday investor to stay on top of their investments, this increased political tweet risk is familiar to professional investors and hedge funds on Wall Street, which have traders 24/7 smart algorithms and models to account for this tweeting risk. However, individual investors do not have the appropriate tools to react in an automatic fashion until now with Trigger. So yeah, people can now get by-the-minute updates on whether or not the president of the United States is tweeting at companies that they hold stock in, causing those companies' stocks to decline. You know, normally you think of the president of the United States as someone who wants to promote American business, wants to do all he can to make sure that certain stocks aren't in decline. President-elect Trump is the opposite. The times we're living in, they are weird, folks. They are quite weird. All right, before we go, I see that our listener rant line is once again blinking, and although I hate to take our listener calls because they usually mean that I'm going to be insulted or owned or whatever, we do this for you people, so let's hear from the listener.
Yes, hello. This is John Q, small business owner. I'm calling in regards to your call segment on yesterday's show. You had a man named Jay who called in, and he lambasted you for your unpaid interns, to which Sam Sachs responded that he would be paying his interns going forward a very generous wage of $20 an hour. I'm just calling in to warn you, as a small business owner myself, that also being my last name, small business owner, that by increasing the wage to your employees, we all know that you're going to pass that cost on to the consumer. And I'm just, you know, fair warning. Anyways, love the show, guys. Long time listener. Have a great day.
You know what, Mr. Small Business Owner, I believe that was his last name, Small Business Owner, very odd last name. I wonder what region of the world he's from. I think he did have a decent point there. You know, one of the great things about the garbage can segment, and really our entire show that we do daily here, is that it's free to listen to. You know, we don't have to make people pay to hear the also important weekly garbage can segment. Unfortunately, since I promised to pay our 27 interns that drag in the garbage can each week $20 an hour for their duties, we just might have to start charging for the segment now. That is, or we can just start laying off interns. I don't know. I'll discuss our options with the other Sam when he gets back into town next week. That'll do it for Unanimous Dissent today. You can listen to this show and all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by checking out our website at districtsentinel.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes by searching for District Sentinel Radio. You can review the episodes. Rate us. Please review, rate us. It's good. We'd like to know how we're doing. Stick around for tomorrow's show. I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to stay here. I'm going to throw someone in the garbage can. I'll be here in DC, so you don't have to be.